I've selected readings by three physicians. First, Albert Schweitzer. Reverence for life comprises the whole ethic of love in its deepest and highest sense. Only a deep-seated change of heart, spreading from one human being to another, can achieve such a thing. Second, Dr. Arthur Kleinman. Illness has meaning. It's something that patients, families, and practitioners must understand together. There's a dialectic at the heart of healing that brings the caregiver into the uncertain, fearful world of pain and disability. It introduces patient and family into the equally uncertain world of therapeutic actions. This dialectic both enhances therapy and it makes of it and the illness a rare opportunity for moral education. And this from Dr. Jerome Groopman, also of Harvard Medical. Patients are awash in a sea of statements about the link between their emotions and their maladies. For years, I diverted or dismissed their inquiries because I didn't know how to answer. Now my response is different. It's formed by the lessons taught to me by my patients and by the stirrings of serious science. We are just beginning to appreciate hope and have not defined its limits. I see hope at the very heart of healing. For those who have hope, it may help some to live longer, and it will help all to live better. Groopman is chair of medicine at Harvard. Long ago, in my Sunday school classes, I heard miracle stories. I was a precocious PK, preacher's kid. And on Sunday evenings, our family drove across town to visit Dr. Fry's family. He was the other Presbyterian minister in town. And my dad and Dr. Fry would sit in the living room smoking their pipes, very foul-smelling Walter Raleigh tobacco. And they would talk theology. And meanwhile, my brother and I and Dr. Fry's kids, we did theology. That is, we created little one-act plays complete with costumes and props based on that morning's Sunday school lesson. Our favorites were the miracle stories, walking on water, changing acorns into glue and fruitcake, things like that. We argued over who got to play which part in our little dramas. And the most desired role was not the one who heals. The best role was the poor soul who, amidst a lifetime of infirmity, would suddenly drink a magic potion and then yelp in delight and begin leaping triple axels around the living room. That was the favorite part. Long ago, through a child's eyes. Now I've come to understand illness and suffering in more complex ways. Arthur Kleinman, whom we heard a minute ago, tells this story. The 7-year-old girl had been badly burned over much of her body. She had to undergo a daily ordeal of a whirlpool bath, during which some of the burnt flesh was tweezered away. This experience was horribly painful for her. She begged the medical team, whose efforts she stubbornly fought off, not to hurt her anymore. I was a neophyte clinical student then. My job was to hold her uninjured hand and to reassure her and calm her and enable the surgical resident to pull away dead infected tissue. Clumsily, uncertain how to proceed, I tried to distract this little patient from her traumatic confrontation with terrible pain. I tried talking to her about her home and family and school, almost anything that might draw her vigilant attention away from her suffering. I could barely endure the daily horror that this little girl was enduring. And then one day, writes Dr. Kleinman, I made contact. At my wit's end, angered at my own impatience and uncertain what to do, besides clutching her small hand, I found myself asking her to tell me how she tolerated it. What the feeling was like of being so badly burned and having to experience the awful surgical ritual day after day. The little girl stopped, quite surprised, and looked at me from a face so disfigured it was difficult to read the expression. And then, in terms direct and simple, she told me. And while she spoke, she grasped my hand. She neither screamed nor fought off the surgeon or the nurse, and each day from then on, her trust established, she tried to give me a feeling of what she was going through. But whatever effect I might have had on her, her effect on me was far more. She taught me that it is possible to engage patients' actual experience of illness. And she taught me that witnessing and helping to order that experience is of powerful therapeutic value. A physician's encounter with anguish, a little girl's anguish, and indeed his own. You know, this topic has been among the more challenging ones I've tried to address. And why is that? And the reason is that hope, I think for a lot of us you use, is an inconvenient truth. A truth that appears to promote the functioning of two essential groups of chemicals, the endorphins and enkephalins, and how these function to promote our body's own healing capacities. How does that promote what our own bodies do? You know, as my life in ministry became seasoned by experience, I realized that caring for each other lies far deeper than what we might say or do. It requires a capacity to trust, to let go, outcomes, prognosis, optimism of what the treatment protocol might lead to. I have to somehow let go a chunk of that, and especially to let go my ego and my need to be needed and my need to somehow be useful so that when I depart from this person, maybe she or he will feel a smidgen better and not just check out, oh my gosh, what did I do? My premise is that bodies don't suffer, people do. The focus of scientific medicine upon the body, of course that's necessary. Is it sufficient? Suffering is experienced by persons, not bodies. Persons who have no manifest symptoms can nonetheless hurt very deeply. Who is this person? I'm thinking of Mary Jo, age 64. She has a rich past, having lived in South Africa most of her life. Painful experiences of apartheid remain as much a part of Mary Jo today as 40 years ago. Events of the present can unleash a host of images from her past. A memorable fragrance drifts by, or a loud explosion on the street. She has not forgotten how to roller skate, and her hands still remember long neglected keyboard skills. All these are part of her personhood. I'm thinking of Jason, age 38, with many roles: father, husband, brother, an orphaned son, uncle. He's also a racquetball opponent, an investment counselor, a volunteer at Habitat for Humanity, and a mathematics tutor for kids in the inner city. All of these are part of his personhood. But if Jason should become suddenly unemployed or injured in an auto accident, his personhood is somehow diminished when he can no longer function in these ways that are a part of his personhood. His suffering from that loss of personhood is far more than whatever biomedical condition he may have. It's physical pain. Now, suppose I'm with someone who is suffering and experiencing loss. That is a loss of their personhood. In that situation, my own ego can get entangled. I want to be helpful and supportive. I want to make a difference. Let's try this thought experiment. What happens when we care deeply for someone but become a little bit cautious, afraid, anxious? If I feel afraid, I might do one of two things. One, I might move back to a safe distance, back away, and treat the person as if their distress is kind of like a minefield with little tripwires in it. When a friend is suffering, the voice of fear may cause me to say, "Oh, I'll be back when you're better. You need some rest. Let's get together again when you're more like the person I remember who you used to be." I can convince myself that this person's emptiness and pain and loss are private matters. Private matters. Who am I to be present for a private personhood tragedy or loss? And so the unspoken message is, I will be waiting for you when you are back to how I remember you, because I am uncomfortable when things are in the pits for you. I don't want reminders of my own mortality, heaven forbid. So I'll be waiting when you're better. Is this? There's a second response that I might turn to amidst suffering, and this is, in a way, the opposite of backing away, and that is trying to be involved. Maybe I can compare their situation with others I may know about. And then, with the best of intentions, I might try to frame and represent this person's complex emotions amidst the loss of their personhood with a few observations. I mean, if I am uncomfortable amidst their discomfort and vulnerability, I may try to conceal my own discomfort with usefulness, one-liners, smiley happy faces, and other bromides to at least relieve my discomfort. And this is my second temptation, to do a kind of end run around this person's diminished personhood. In the story we heard a few moments ago from Dr. Kleinman, after who knows how long, he was open to hearing about and experiencing the tweezering of this burnt flesh and the loss of personhood of this young girl. So what's the alternative? Do we seek a middle ground between backing away and over-involved? I don't think it's a middle ground question. Perhaps we try too hard to offer comfort in words. Hey, we're verbal folks. But a wounded spirit and the loss of a personhood is responsive to sustaining love in ways beyond words. The touch of a hand can dispel the sense of aloneness. A silent presence can be even more eloquent than even the loveliest words, we may offer our own reflection, but that is for us. We do that for ourselves and not for the grief-stricken and not for those who are experiencing loss. For that is a loss that we cannot express for them and can't presume to. And yet it is something to know that others are holding us in compassion. To know that other hands are reaching out through that seemingly impenetrable darkness which bears in upon our spirits. To know the tactile presence of love which respects our grief and shares it. Keeping alight that little candle in our lives which flickered and seemed to go out as the darkness gathered in this way that only love can offer. Time will bring healing in ways that words cannot. But that healing of time and the body's own resources for healing, they wait upon the sustaining love of friends and strangers, the continuing labor for which even in our own darkness, the world waits upon us to do. My friends, as we go forward, it's my hope and prayer that this will be our resolve and our hope and promise to one another in the days and years ahead. And that this will be your navigational compass, your gyroscopic reference point in your shared ministry with Reverend Laura. May you continue to bring that thing with feathers that perches in the soul, singing songs, and she will sing songs with you, songs without the words, and never stop at all.